said Campbell, relentlessly. It was nothing to do with me. I didn't even know about it until afterwards. That man's beyond controlling. Ramirez had picked up my injudicious reference to Kane, and was looking at me inquiringly. He was very acute. "You have spoken to Kane again, Mr. Trevelyan? He was supposed to come to me, in Nuku'alofa, but I didn't see him there." I tried to make the best of my slip. "Yes, we've spoken to him. He's told us a great deal, too. Enough to condemn the lot of you. So think carefully about what you're planning, Ramirez. Might one ask where he is?" "Where you won't find him, and all ready to sing like a bird." He looked thoughtful, and did not speak again for a moment, and Campbell, sensing a faint opening, was quick to take advantage. "What were you planning to do with us? It won't work, you know." "You speak stupidly," Ramirez said. Mark watched us, fascinated, all his boasting silenced. He'd shocked us, but he'd failed to impress us, and now things were taking a turn that he didn't like. It was slowly becoming obvious to me that in spite of Mark's almost insane posturing, it was Ramirez who was the more powerful of the two, and possibly the more dangerous. Campbell said, "You've decided that you can't leave us alive, haven't you? That would be too much to expect. You've already killed some 17 people. Another dozen or so won't make any difference. But you won't get away with it. We have covered our tracks, Ramirez. And for another thing, your own crew will talk about all this sooner or later." It was a bold try, and I had never admired Campbell more. Ramirez threw back his head and laughed. "My crew, those morons." He gestured to the stolid guards. "Those oafs? They do what I tell them, and nothing else. They have no mind of their own. I am the only brain they have. And who would believe them if they talked? They have never understood what it is all about, not one of them. Besides, that can be taken care of too." "A series of unfortunate accidents?" asked Campbell, sardonically. "Regrettable, isn't it?" I listened to this ghastly conversation with a feeling of unreality. Ramirez was prepared to kill us, without compunction. What was more, he was equally prepared to kill his own crew as well. I could just imagine how it would be arranged. The men would be well paid, split up, and dispersed. And then there would be, as Campbell foresaw, a series of accidents. A man found dead in a harbour here, a fatal car smash there, until the whole crew was disposed of. "All right," Campbell was saying. "You still won't get away with it. Quite apart from Kane's evidence, you don't suppose I haven't made my own arrangements, do you? My agents have sealed letters, which will be handed to the police if I don't turn up somewhere soon. There's gonna be one hell of an investigation if I go missing." "You're an old fool," said Ramirez brutally. "The glove's off at last. The barometer has dropped 3 points in the last hour. There's a storm coming up, and that thing out there is going crazy. You're going to be lost at sea, the lot of you. We will not be anywhere near here. There will be no proof. No proof of anything." Campbell shuddered, and Claire pulled a little closer to him. Watching Ramirez, I was fascinated by a movement outside the port light behind his head. Nobody else had seemed to see it, too appalled and horror-stricken by the finality in Ramirez's voice. I saw Taffy, crouched at the end of the settee, fumble again with that curious gesture at the back of his neck, but his eyes never left Ramirez. Campbell said slowly, Ramirez, you're a bloody-minded butcher. Ramirez spread his hands. I don't like killing for killing's sake. I'm no Jim Hagley. He was stupid back on Tanakobu, and I abhor that, putting pleasure before business. I kill only from necessity. But when I do, whether it's 17 or 70 lives, doesn't make much difference. Lives are cheap, my friend, when there are large stakes. I consider my measures necessary. He was as cold as a snake. I switched my gaze back to the port and caught my breath. There was a face out there, and I winked. Bill Hunter was back on board. He was a hidden ace that Ramirez must not become aware of. I cautiously lifted my hand to my mouth, coughed, and then made a slow downward movement, being careful not to jerk. I didn't want to catch anyone's attention. The eye winked again, and the face disappeared. Campbell was still speaking, desperately searching for arguments to persuade Ramirez not to go ahead with whatever plans he had for us. Again, there was that vibrancy in my ears, a curious beat in Campbell's voice, as though there were some sort of oral interference, some note so low as to be inaudible. Not far away, there was a sound as though an engine were letting off steam. Esmeralda shuddered, and the noises on deck increased suddenly. Ramirez interrupted Campbell, turned, and to my horror, strode over to look out of a porthole. I tensed, but then he turned back and spoke again, and I realized he'd not seen anything untoward. "Whatever is going on out there will serve its purpose," he said coolly. "As soon as these idiots of mine have parted, the two ships we go our separate ways. You won't have far to go. A mile or so. Straight down. We will tow you into deep water, or point your nose into that thing out there." He turned on Geordie. "We have borrowed an idea from you, Captain. We will set an explosive charge against your hull, and that storm out there will do the rest." Geordie ground his teeth together, but said nothing. Somebody ran across the deck over our heads, and a voice called out. Ramirez cocked his head and glanced upwards. "It sounds as though they are about ready." I heard a clatter of heavy boots on the companion steps, and there was a thump on the door. At a gesture from Ramirez, one of the guards opened it, and Hadley came in. He looked at us with an oafish grin that didn't reach his pale, cold eyes, and bent to whisper to Ramirez, who immediately turned to look out of the porthole again. I thanked God that Bill had kept out of sight. Or had he? Ramirez turned back. "Which would you choose? Deep water or Falcon Island? There seems to be increased activity over there." He smiled and said to Mark, "This is lucky, you know. Where else should a survey ship be wrecked but in investigating Falcon Island a little too closely at the wrong time? Keep our friends happy for a little while." He turned on his heel and left the saloon, followed by Hadley. Geordie watched them go and then transferred his attention to Mark. "You're a poor specimen of a man," he said with contempt. "What makes you think I'm going to sit back and let you wreck my ship and murder my crew? If I'm going to be killed, I might as well take you with me." He began to rise from his chair. With Ramirez's departure, a curious change had come into the atmosphere. It was as if we could all recognize that where Ramirez had real authority and total amorality, Mark had only his ego and his self-seeking veneer of toughness over a very insecure personality. As Geordie started to rise, Mark snapped out a command in Spanish, and the guards' rifles lifted to the ready. "Be careful," Mark said. "They're trained killers." "So am I," said Geordie, with menace. He continued to rise slowly, and Ian started to get up as well. Mark spoke again in Spanish, and one of the guards casually fired his rifle, apparently without aim. The noise was appalling, and we flinched back as splinters flew from the bullet as it struck the cabin sole just by Geordie's foot. He hesitated, and I spoke sharply. "Cut it, Geordie. You haven't a chance. You can't move faster than a bullet." Geordie glared at me under his lowered brows, but I made a quick slashing gesture with my hand, and, taking a chance, winked at him. His brow smoothed, and he sat down again, as did Ian. Both were watchful, and I knew that I had succeeded in alerting them. There was a sustained racket from overhead. Geordie said, "They're making a muck-up of it out there, aren't they?" "Mind if I smoke, Claire?" I put my hand into a pocket and stopped as a rifle barrel turned, and the muzzle pointed unwaveringly at me. "For God's sake, Mark, can't I even have a cigarette?" He looked amused. "Smoking's bad for you, Mike. Go ahead, but you'd better have nothing but cigarettes in your hand when you pull it out." Slowly I withdrew my hand as he spoke to the guards again. The rifle barrel drooped a little, and I opened the packet and put a cigarette in my mouth. And at that moment I saw Bill's face at the port once more. The sound of the rifle had brought him back, as I'd hoped it would. The saloon door opened, and there was a brief exchange between one of our guards and a man outside, and then it closed again. Clearly, Ramirez, too, had sent to ask about the shooting. I put my hand to my pocket again and said to the man with the rifle, "Phosphorus?" He made no sign, and I managed to get the matches out without being threatened. I lit the cigarette and said, "Look, Mark, you know everybody cooped up in this saloon. Some have been your friends, others have been more than your friends, a lot more. In God's name, what kind of a man are you?" I found it hard to speak to him without my voice betraying me. "What can I do?" he asked, petulantly. "Do you think I want to see you all killed? It's out of my hands. Ramirez is in control here." Claire's voice was cutting. "He washes his hands, the new Pontius Pilate." "Damn it, Claire. You don't think I want to see you at the bottom of the sea? I can't do anything, I tell you." Campbell said, "It's no use, Mike. He wouldn't do anything to save us even if he could. His neck's at stake, you know?" This was my chance. To speak to Campbell, I had to half turn away from Mark and the guards in a natural fashion. "He'll join us anyway," I said. "Ramirez has got what he wants now. He doesn't need Mark anymore. He only needs to take my notes with him, and I'm damn sure he'll want to rub out any witness to all this, including Mark." I was printing on the back of the cigarette packet with a stub of pencil I had taken from my pocket with the matches. The words, as large as I could make them, were "cable hold." I drooped my eyelid at Campbell, and he caught on fast. He shook his fist at Mark to divert attention, and started acting up a little. "You damned murderer," he shouted. "Shut up," said Mark, venomously. "Just shut up, damn you." I held up the cigarette packet towards Campbell and said, "Take it easy. Have one?" "No, no." He brushed my offer aside, but the job was done, and Bill had had a clear vision of my message over Campbell's shoulder. I hoped to God that he had good eyesight. Claire saw the message too, and her eyes widened. She bent her head over the still prostrate Paula to hide her expression. I saw her whisper in the other girl's ear, apparently still soothing her. I said to Mark, still playing for time, "Why the hell should he shut up? We've got nothing to lose by telling you what we think of you. I'm sickened at the thought of you being any kin to me." Mark's jaw tightened, and he said nothing. I had to goad him into speaking. I risked a glance at the port and saw that the face had gone, to be replaced with a hand. The middle finger and thumb were joined in a circle. Bill had got my message. Whatever happened now, I had to give him time to act on it. Now he knew where the rest of us were, and might be able to do something about it. I wondered if he was alone, or if Jim and Rex were still with him. It was a slim chance, but it was all we had. I reckoned that the only thing we could do to help was to get at Mark in some way, and in his highly nervous state, that might prove deadly dangerous. I said, "What put you on to us? The sea's a big place, Mark. But of course you always knew where that high cobalt nodule formation was, didn't you?" "I only knew approximately. I wasn't the only one doing assays on that damned IGY ship, and I couldn't get at all the information I wanted." His sullen tone implied that such information should have been his by rights, which was typical of him. But I was on the right track in getting him to talk about his own cleverness. Few genuine egotists can resist such an appeal. "Who had the bright idea that found us here, then? We could have been anywhere. We could have been 100 miles from here. You couldn't know where we were." He laughed. "Couldn't I? Couldn't we? I know you're like a book, Mike. I knew that you'd find that deposit given time to survey properly, so I gave you that time. And I knew that once you'd found it, you couldn't resist investigating the source. I knew you'd have to come to Funuafu, to Falcon. Ramirez couldn't see it, of course. He can be a stupid man at times. But I convinced him that I knew my own brother. We've been hanging around here for 2 bloody weeks waiting for you to turn up." I said, "How did you get tangled with Ramirez?" We already knew the answer to that one, but it kept him talking. "Campbell there couldn't finance me, and Suarez Navarro could. It was as simple as that. Who else should I go to but them? They'd just shown that they weren't too scrupulous by what they'd done to his mines, so they were just what I wanted. And then they led you into murder. You had to kill Norgard." "That was an accident," said Mark, irritably. "All Sven was doing was tying up loose ends. We were waiting for the hue and cry to die down, and then Suarez Navarro were going to provide us with a proper survey ship to find this stuff." He thumped the papers and notebook. "Meantime, that damn fool decided that he wanted to publish. You see, he didn't know much about Suarez Navarro, and that's the way I wanted it. We had an argument. He was a pretty excitable chap. At first in words, and then it came to blows. The next thing I knew was that he'd cracked his head open on the coral. But I didn't mean to kill him, Mike. I swear it. All I ever wanted to do was to shut him up." "All you ever want to do is shut people up," I said flatly. "How do you go about shutting up a good scientist, Mark? It seems to me that the only way is to kill him." I was cold inside, chilled by his amoral egocentricity. Everything he had done was justified in his own eyes, and everything that had gone wrong was the fault of other people. Mark waved me aside. "Hadley knew, of course. He was my liaison with Ramirez. They helped me to cover it up, but somehow the police got onto it." "My God, you think I'm naive," I said. "Look, Mark, I wouldn't be surprised if Ramirez didn't tip off the police himself. It wouldn't matter to him. He was in the clear. He arranged for your death, and that was that. But he had you neatly wrapped in a package from then on, and you couldn't do a thing without his say-so." "It wasn't like that," Mark muttered. "Wasn't it? Even when the first plan went wrong and Hadley was implicated in your so-called murder, Ramirez wasn't worried. That's why he laughed his damn head off when I accused him. He knew that all he ever had to do to clear himself and Hadley was to produce you, and you can be sure he'd do it in such a way that would earn him the congratulations of the law."
"What do you mean by that?"
"He'd produce you dead, or dying, Mark, just so you couldn't talk. And the police would pat him on the back for capturing Mark Trevelyan, the murderer of Sven Norgard, and maybe the mastermind behind the killing of Schouten.
By God, I was right when I called you stupid. You'd really got in over your head, hadn't you?
He was angry and baffled, and I could see that my attack had hit home. Doubt was in his every action. Campbell said,
"It doesn't make any difference now, Mark. You're for the Deep Six along with the rest of us. Ramirez will see to that."
Geordi laughed without humour.
"Do you think you can trust Ramirez?"
Mark thought deeply, and then shook his head.
"Maybe you're right," he admitted,
and I don't think he had often used those words in his lifetime.
"But it still makes no difference. You want me to help you, but I can't. You'll never beat him. And if you did, I'd still be wanted for murder. I'd rather stick to Ramirez and take my chances. He still needs me." I wanted to try and tell him how wrong he was, but something else had finally penetrated to my consciousness. There was a whistling sound in the distance. High-pressure steam was escaping somewhere. Mark looked out of the porthole, and what he saw over the water made him acutely unhappy.
"Damn them! What are they doing on deck?" he muttered. "This is no time to be hanging around here."
His nervousness increased, and he conferred with one of the guards in a low voice. An argument seemed to develop as the guard answered back, but Mark overbore him. With a black glance and a reluctant shrug, the guard opened the saloon door and went out. I looked at Geordi with hopeful eyes, and he nodded grimly. The odds were improving, but anything we tried would have to be done before the guard returned. Geordi's hand crept towards the heavy glass ashtray on the table, and then relaxed near it. He couldn't throw it faster than the guard could shoot, but he was ready if a chance came up. We were all sitting tensely. There was a reddish reflection in Mark's face as he went again to look out of the porthole. Evidently things were stirring on Falcon. I said, "What's going on out there, Mark?" His voice was strained.
"It looks as though Falcon is going to bust loose."
I felt suddenly colder. Mark and I were possibly the only two people on either ship qualified to have any understanding of what that might mean. I said, "How close are we?"
"Maybe a quarter of a mile."
He straightened his back and added, "It's happened a couple of times this week already. It's never amounted to much. Great sight, but that's all." But he was not convincing. We were much too close to Fanua Fa'u. To Ramirez and Hadley, it might seem a good safe distance, especially if they had been watching pre-eruption patterns all week. But Mark and I knew better. We knew what volcanic eruptions could do. No wonder Mark was scared. So was I. He looked at the remaining guard, hesitated, and then spoke to him. The guard shook his head vigorously, and as Mark started to leave, he stepped in front of the door and raised his rifle. Campbell said ironically,
"What's the matter, Mark? Doesn't he trust you?"
The whistling and belching suddenly increased, and Esmeralda lurched, her joints squealing a protest. We swung round, still locked with Serena. There was a sudden blast of acrid, sulphurous smell in the air. Mark's eyes darted from the guard to me, and our glances locked as tightly as the ship's. Mark said sharply,
"He doesn't want to be left here alone with you lot. I must wait for the other guard."
He crossed to the porthole and looked out again, and I felt bile rise in my throat. Geordi said,
"What the hell's the matter?"
He didn't have time to finish. Esmeralda gave another great lurch and went over almost on her beam ends. I slithered helplessly towards the side of the saloon and jarred my head against the table as I fell. There were sounds of bedlam above decks. The ship righted herself, and we fell back in a jumble of bodies. I heard Campbell groan. It must have been hell for him in his condition. Geordi was up first. He grasped the ashtray and hurled it at the guard, and then leapt the length of the saloon. The guard tried frantically to retrieve his rifle from the deck where it had fallen. He had his fingers on the butt when Geordi kicked him with precision in the jaw, and his face disappeared into a bloody ruin. Ian had gone for Mark, and any trace of his normal Highland gentleness had vanished. His face was a mask of rage. Geordie had grabbed the rifle and turned it on Mark. They converged on him, but Mark managed to evade them both and scrambled towards the saloon door. There was a curious flicker in the air, and he slumped. His hand clapped to his right hip, and I saw blood welling between his fingers. I had raised myself to go after Geordie, and a shouted word of protest was already on my lips, but as Mark fell, both Ian and Geordie came to an abrupt stop, the momentary bloodlust dying from their faces. All eyes were on the gleaming, bloodied blade on the floor beside Mark. "Who threw the knife?" I demanded. Taffy came from the far end of the saloon. "I did." He saw the look that sparked in my eyes and added hastily, "I wouldn't have killed him, Mike, even though he deserves it. I know where to put a knife." "Well, you'd better come and get it," I said. He came forward to take it from the deck and carefully wiped it on his trouser leg. Claire was looking at him, ashen-faced, but Paula had already pushed forward to Mark's side. I said, "I saw you searched like the rest of us, Taffy. How did you hide the knife?" "I had it dangling down the small of my back on a piece of string. It's an old trick, but they fell for it." For the moment, the crisis was past. I looked anxiously out to sea. There was a haze of steam in the near distance, and beyond it, the swell of sullen black clouds still rolled skywards. The sea was choppy, with little eddies swirling here and there, and around the fringe of the steam there was a white roil of froth. The smell was fitful and nasty. Closer in, I saw our motor launch swinging astern with nobody on board her. There was no sign of Bill nor of anyone else on deck. In the saloon, Ian was helping Campbell back onto the settee with Claire to lend him a hand. Paula was bandaging Mark, and Geordie was searching the prostrate guard. Taffy was missing. "Geordie, where's Taffy?" "Danny Williams was a special mate of his, you know." "Damn it. We need teamwork, not single-minded heroics." "Easy now," Geordie said. "Taffy never was a good team man, but he's deadly on his own. He'll do a hell of a lot of damage." "All right for him, but we need a plan of action urgently. Taffy's loose and Bill is somewhere on deck, and with luck, Rex and Jim are with him. Maybe they've been able to do something. And there's us, three men and a rifle." "Four men," snapped Campbell, getting to his feet. "And if those sons of bitches haven't searched our cabins, there'll be guns in them." He met my eyes with a cold blue glare. He was right. He'd be no good in a brawl, but give him one of his target pistols and he could be deadly. Claire looked from her father to me, and there was something of the same hard wildness in her face. "I'm coming with you," she said. "Claire, you can't." She cut in decisively. "I'm a pretty good shot too, remember? Better than you, Mike. You're going to need all the help you can get." She was determined to stay close to me and her father, and she was right. We would need her. And if it came to the worst, for her, as for the rest of us, death by a bullet was preferable to drowning, clawing for air in a scuttled ship. My throat closed up with fear for her, but I couldn't argue with her decision. She moved to the liquor cabinet. Several bottles had broken in the roll, and she picked one up and stared at the jagged edges. She said slowly, "I've seen them do this in movies." I thought that she could probably never use it, but it gave her some confidence. Geordie actually chuckled from the doorway. "That's the stuff," he said. "Come on, we haven't much time. Me first, then Ian. Mike, you bring up the rear." Paula was bending over Mark. She met my eye and shook her head slightly. Mark lay back with his eyes closed, though whether he was unconscious or shamming it was impossible to guess. "Okay, Paula, you stay here with him," I said. Geordie opened the door and slipped out. One by one, we followed him cautiously into the passageway. He hadn't gone more than a few feet when he stopped, stepped over something, and then moved on. It was the body of our second guard. He must have been on his way back to the saloon when he met up with Taffy. His throat was cut in a gaping gash, and the front of his shirt was sodden and dyed scarlet with blood. Claire swayed a little as she looked down, and I took her firmly by the arm and pushed her past. We moved ahead to Campbell's cabin and went inside to find that it hadn't been searched. Campbell took his valise from the bottom of the wardrobe and unrolled it, looking satisfied and stronger with every movement. There were three guns in it, his own and Claire's, and the one Geordie had taken from Ramirez back in Nuku'alofa. Father and daughter quickly loaded their weapons, and Claire discarded the jagged bottle with obvious relief. In our cabin, Geordie and I found our two pistols untouched, and as we loaded them, Campbell nodded with approval. "Now we've got a fighting chance," he said. We crept on, without interruption, to the aft companionway. Geordie climbed up cautiously, then ducked back. There was a man standing above on the deck, silhouetted against that yellow glowing sky. He was holding a rifle. Geordie laid his own weapon aside and moved slowly up the steps. Then he motioned me to follow. Ian was the professional, but being much slighter than the Scot, I had a better chance of reaching the deck simultaneously with Geordie. Geordie leapt swiftly up and took the guard from behind, one arm swinging round his neck and the other grabbing the rifle. I scrambled after him and clubbed a man with the butt of my gun. He collapsed in a heap. We dropped him down the companionway like a sack of potatoes. With a grim smile, Geordie said to me, "You're learning, laddie." We followed the body back down again. We now had three rifles and a small assortment of handguns. The odds were getting better all the time. Geordie, making his disposition of his troops, said, "Mike, I want us to take a look at Falcon. You come with me. Ian, cover our ear. Mr. Campbell, you and Claire keep watch down here and shoot anybody who tries to come down that passageway, as long as they aren't ours." We slipped quietly on deck, and I got my first full look at Falcon. The yellow glow seemed to be diminishing, but there was a lot more steam, and sheets of a rain-like substance were falling to one side of the troubled area. In the middle of it all, the dense black smoke billowed upwards with fleeting streaks of red intermingled in it. The sea there was heaving and broken, but the ships were still in an area of almost untroubled ocean, save for the hurrying turbulence on the surface. The whistle of high-pressure steam was deafening, a bad sign, and the smell was gut-wrenching. I stared in utter fascination. But once on deck, Geordie was more concerned with his ship. He looked up at the foremast. "Christ, what a mess. They haven't cleared her yet." In the dazzle of sunlight, looking upwards, I could see that the two masts were almost separated. They now seemed to be locked only somewhere high up. The taller Serena leaned over Esmeralda at an angle, and there was a hellish tangle of lines, broken spars, and general debris scattered everywhere. The motor launch still hung astern, but from where we stood, there was no sign of our dinghy. "They're still busy," Geordie murmured. "We'll make for the winch. We can hide there while we try to open the cable hold." There was nobody at the wheel, but ahead I could see knots of men at the foot of each mast. Some were up the masts working to free the wreckage, and I hoped to God they were too occupied to look down and spot us. "We'll have to chance it," Geordie said, and gestured to Ian to follow us. We ran forward in a crouch, keeping to the shadow of the deckhouse. At the end of it, Geordie paused, caught my arm, and pointed. There was a slight movement in the shadow of the winch drum, and to get there, we would have no further cover. "Bill or Taffy?" he breathed. A hand came out into the light and fumbled with the fastenings of the hatch cover. Ahead, The men on board Serena seemed to be watching the attempt to clear the mast, or looking back towards Falcon, and there was a good chance that they wouldn't see a man if he moved stealthily across the deck. A wild dash would be suicide. The disembodied hand was still working on the hatch cover. "I'm going to undo the other side," I said quietly to Geordie. "Cover me." A rumble came clearly across the water from Falcon, cutting through all other noises, and the red flashes of light in the black cloud suddenly flared higher. Voices were raised in alarm, and there was a stampede of running footsteps. The diversion was well-timed, and I slid along the deck, clutching for the edge of the hatch, and pulled myself to lie close alongside. Groping for the catches, I saw that my companion was Bill Hunter. I had released one catch and was attacking the other when there was the sharp crackle of gunfire and the thunder of feet. Ian and Geordie were on their knees, firing at Serena's men, who were pounding aft towards us. A contorted face loomed over me, the butt of a rifle poised over my skull. I jerked to one side and it slammed into the deck. Then I heard the distinctive spat of Campbell's target pistol, and my assailant grew a third eye in the middle of his forehead and crashed on top of me. I shoved his body aside and grabbed for the hatch. The second catch came free, and Bill and I heaved the cover up and flung it open. Four men came boiling out of it, ready for blood. Geordie screamed, "Aft! Get aft!" We all tumbled down behind the deckhouse. More shots rang out, and Ian scored a hit. The rest of Serena's crew retreated back to the mast as covering fire came from on board their ship. It seemed to come from their deckhouse, but it was hard to tell in the confusion. Geordie looked us over, counting heads, and to my intense pleasure, the face of Jim Taylor was amongst them. At least one of the dinghy crew was safe, which gave me hope for Rex Larking. Bill gave me a quick thumbs-up sign. Sporadic fire came from Serena. There was at least one sharpshooter up the main mast, and Geordie ducked as a bullet sent splinters flying just above his head. "This is no good," he said. "There's not enough cover, and we're running out of ammo." Then came the methodically spaced shots from Campbell's pistol. There was a scream from the yardarm, and a dark figure fell, all spinning arms and legs, to Serena's deck. Geordie got us moving aft, leaving Nick and Ian to cover our retreat. In the companionway, Campbell was reloading the pistol as we swarmed below. His lips were curled back in a fierce grin. He motioned us aside, curtly, and aimed at the yardarm, crouching to steady himself in the hatchway. Another body plummeted down, this time into the sea. "That's the lad," Campbell said. He looked drawn and white, and near the end of his endurance. In the passageway, Claire was standing with her pistol held in a steady hand. The alarm in her face subsided when she saw us. I caught and held her briefly. The men gathered below, and there was a swift redistribution of weapons. Nick lifted a brawny fist. "I won't need a gun," he said. He was holding a huge Stilson wrench. A few more shots came from above, but they died away, and a short time later, Nick and Taffy reported that Esmeralda was clear of enemies below decks at least, with the exception of my brother. Jim and Geordie went to reconnoitre the forward companionway after a brief word with Campbell. Somehow he persuaded the Canadian to stay back in the saloon with Mark, Paula and Claire, and I forbore to ask him whether he'd done it by tact or threat. I was deeply relieved either way. "They've retreated. They're all aboard Serena." Geordie was back with a report. "I didn't see any sign of Ramirez, but Hadley's all over the place, bellowing orders. He's making a reet foul up of the job, too. We're still locked on down them." "What about Falcon?" I asked. "Same as before. It's pretty fierce out there, but we've checked the engines and there's no sabotage there, thank the Lord. We're going to have to get clear of Serena and away bloody fast as soon as we can." "But how?" We all looked at one another, desperately searching for ideas. Geordie swung round to Hunter. "Bill, how did you get back on board? And where's Rex? Is he okay?" Bill didn't know about Danny yet, but I'd seen his eyes scanning our bunch and he looked grim. It took him a moment to reply. "I'm sorry, Skipper. We lost him. We saw some of Serena's lot take over the launch. They held guns on our lads and threw them a line to haul them in. They hadn't seen us, so I got Rex and Jim here to slip over the dinghy side, and we swamped her. Jim and I got back on board, okay, up our ladder, but we had Rex between us, and when Esmeralda lurched over, he let go. God, Geordie, you did your best." "It's another one to chalk up to Ramirez," said Geordie, curtly. I left them together, and went up to take another look at Falcon, feeling sick and depressed. The launch still bobbed at the end of its line, but somewhere under that twitching sea lay our dinghy and one of our crewmen. The distance to the belching gout of smoke seemed less. Either we were dragging our anchor, which was very likely with the disturbance under her hull and the extra weight of Serena alongside, or the area of eruption was enlarging, an even more alarming prospect. There was even more steam than before, and I longed to know what was going on behind that red-lit, misty curtain. I would have very much liked to ask Mark's opinion. I went back down to Geordie. "We've got to get out of here before Falcon really starts acting up." He looked across the sea. "It's weird, I'll grant you, but is it that serious? Lots of observers have seen eruptions at sea before now, and Mark said it's been going on for days already." "This is just an overture," I said. "No time now to begin a lecture on undersea volcanology. I don't think we should be around when the finale is being played." "Oh, I want out too, make no mistake. But we've got a closer problem than Falcon right now. Our friend's out there. I wish to God I knew where Ramirez was and what he's planning. Bill, could you see any sign of tampering with our hull? They threatened us with explosives." Bill shook his head. "No, Skipper, at least not that I've seen." My warning about Falcon seemed to have passed Geordie by. It was something quite out of his experience. He was still wholly concerned with unshackling Esmeralda, and certainly for the moment, he was right. I asked, "What the hell can we do?" "Well, whoever's in command over there, Ramirez or Hadley, will want to get free as much as we do. They're in danger just as we are, and I don't think they'll find it so easy to retake us now or blow us up as they threatened. Knowing Ramirez, he may be prepared to cut his losses. And try another time? Another time isn't our problem right now. Let's solve this one first." He was right, and we waited in silence, aware that a plan was forming in his mind. At last he said, "I reckon we should call a truce. If we send a man up the mast, they won't fire at him, if they know why he's going up there." "Well, what's the good of sending one man up? They've had a dozen men up there for an age, and they haven't been able to achieve much." "I've got an idea about that," Geordie said, and passed the word for Jim to join us. "Got any more of that plastic explosive, Jim?" he asked. Jim shook his head. "No, I only had the bit I used on their engine." Geordie pointed to the masts. "See that yardarm, where it's tangled with rigging? Could you blow it off if you fastened a hand grenade on each side of the spar?" I stared at him, but Jim was already immersed in technicalities. "It would be a bit tricky, Skipper. Grenades aren't exactly meant for that sort of thing." He peered at the spars doubtfully. "It's steel tubing." "Of course," said Geordie. "If it was wood, they'd have chopped it through by now. Steel halyards, too." "I don't know," said Jim, honestly. "It would weaken the spar, though, wouldn't it?" Geordie persisted. "It wouldn't do it any good, if that's what you want." "Hell, come down to brass tacks. Suppose I have the engine going and put a strain on the yardarm after the grenades are blown. Do you think that would do the trick?" "I reckon it might," said Jim slowly.
It would be a nice job to place the grenades right.
Geordie had trapped him neatly.
You'll have a go, then. You're our expert.
Jim grinned.
I'll give it a bash, if they don't shoot me.
Good, said Geordie, briskly. We'll take care of that part of it. You gather together what you need, and I'll get those grenades. I knew we'd find a use for them.
Mike, you'll be the best man to negotiate. Try to settle terms for an armistice with that bunch of pirates.
I wondered if Ramirez would realize that if he let us go, he might never catch up with us again. We would forever be a threat to his freedom, and he might never agree to such terms. There seemed to be too many imponderables, and there was Falcon. We were very vulnerable, underarmed, undermanned, and in no position to dictate terms. And then I thought of Claire, and how precious she had become to me. Whatever else, I was determined that she should survive, and to hell with the rest. I crawled into the wheelhouse, keeping below window level, and raised the loudhailer.
"Ahoy, Serena!" I shouted. "Ahoy, Ramirez! Can you hear me?"
A shot was fired at the wheelhouse. I heard the smash of broken glass, and a small shower of it fell near me. There was shouting, and then silence. The only sound came from the ships as they creaked and groaned together, and from the hissing of the volcano behind us.
"Serena! Ramirez! I want to talk to you!"
My knuckles were white round the loudhailer. The silence was finally broken by a harsh voice.
"Well, is that you, Ramirez?"
"Yes. What do you want?"
"That volcano. It's going to erupt at any moment. Hell, it's started."
"I know."
He sounded frustrated, and I almost smiled with relief. He'd cooperate.
"We have an idea."
"What can you do?"
"We want to send a man up the foremast. We can clear that rigging."
His voice was full of suspicion.
"How can you do that?"
I did not intend to tell him our plan. I called,
"We have an expert here. We want you to guarantee that he won't be shot at."
There was an even longer silence this time. Someone tapped me on my shoulder and pushed a note into my hands. It was from Geordie, and read, "Got to slip the anchor, quiet as possible. Good luck." The silence was broken by Ramirez.
"All right, Esmeralda, we don't shoot."
I called,
"Ramirez, if our man is shot at, you'll be dead within the hour. Every man here will make you his personal target."
"You terrify me."
Was he laughing?
"You can send your man up the mast in 5 minutes. I will arrange things at this end."
I crawled out of the wheelhouse and joined Geordie, who had Campbell beside him. Geordie said,
"We heard that. What do you think?"
"I think he'll hold off," I said. "He's in as big a jam as we are, and he knows it, and he must accept that we do have more expertise aboard here than he has."
"It's not your neck," said Campbell sharply. He was right back on form.
"Jim will be an Aunt Sally if he goes up there."
"It will be his decision," Geordie said. "I got some lads up in the bows to slip the anchor. They've timed it in with that to cover any noise."
He nodded towards Falcon. I said,
"That makes this really urgent. It scares me to death."
Jim had joined us and was listening gravely as Geordie explained. Then he said,
"All right. I know the odds. I'll have a go."
I said, "We've got 3 minutes left. At 1 minute, I'll call Ramirez again." We waited, huddled in the corner of the wheelhouse. The minutes ticked by as we listened to the ominous rumbling and hissing from the sea. I turned to Geordie. "We're only 40-odd miles from Nuku'alofa. A fast boat could reach us in a couple of hours. Surely that would be some protection for us. What's the chance of getting off a radio message?"
Geordie's voice was bitter. "The radio was the first thing they smashed. It's feared.
Shorty's trying to whip up a spark transmitter out of the wreckage, but he says it'll take time. There was one other faint hope, the possibility of the pall of black smoke being seen and investigated. But we knew only too well how few ships there were in this locality. None of them would be very fast, and as soon as any sensible skipper came near enough to see what was happening, the chances were that he would keep well clear. Every track of thought seemed to lead to a dead end. I crawled into the wheelhouse again and took up the loudhailer.
"Ramirez! I hear you. Our man's going forward now, in the open. He has a bag of tools with him. No shooting."
"No shooting," he agreed. "I have told my men."
I watched through the window as Jim walked to the foremast, a satchel slung round his shoulder. He climbed the mast steadily. Almost all our crew were watching from various hidden vantage points, several with rifles or pistols handy. Jim reached the yardarm, paused, then swung the satchel in front of him and put his hand inside. He'd have to clip his way through some of the tangle first. On board Serena, there was no one in sight. Like us, they were staying in cover. There was a sudden lurch of the two ships as an eddy caught us. I was braced and swaying with a movement, hoping to God that Jim had a firm handhold and that he wouldn't drop a grenade. Suddenly, from Serena's wheelhouse came a babble of voices, and a second later, Hadley came running on deck into full view. He was laughing, and he carried a submachine gun. Swiftly, he raised it and fired a burst at the foremast. Jim toppled from the yardarm, falling with limbs awry to slam with a dull thud across the starboard bulkhead. If the bullets hadn't killed him, then that fall would surely have done so. There was an angry roar from Esmeralda, and guns began firing. Hadley stepped back into the shadows, still laughing, and sprayed the rest of the magazine across our decks. Splinters flew on deck at the madman's feet, but he seemed to dance away from the bullets and vanished into cover. Hadley's blast had shattered the rest of the wheelhouse windows. I catapulted myself out of there towards Geordie and Campbell. Geordie was speechless with rage and grief. Campbell was snarling. "The goddamn maniac! I'll have his guts," Geordie said stiffly. The firing from our crew died away, and I saw faces staring, stunned by the horror of what they'd seen. Two men broke cover to go and collect Jim's body. No one shot at them. Slowly, I followed the others below for a counsel and found Claire waiting for us in the passageway, white-faced and rigid. She came and clung to me, and I held her tightly, and for a moment the only reality seemed to be my love for her.
"Dear God, Mike, Pop, what happened up there?"
"Jim's been killed," Campbell said shortly.
"They've got a raving maniac over there," I told her.
"Hadley, he's lost all control."
"I'll kill him," said Geordie.
"Geordie, wait. This isn't a war, and you're not some bloody-minded general who doesn't care how many men he loses to the cause. We've lost Danny and Jim and Rex, and other men are wounded. We haven't a hope of getting aboard Serena. We'd be massacred."
"Hell, what other way is there?"
he asked, still spoiling for a fight. There was a growl of approval from most of our crew. I felt as they did, but I had to stop them.
"Look, Hadley's run mad, and there's no knowing what he'll do next. But I'll bet those Spaniards over there are even more scared of him than we are. I think Ramirez will have him dealt with for their own safety."
Geordie's face was still shuttered and frozen. He wasn't going to listen. Then Campbell said,
"Don't forget we're drifting now. You slipped the anchor." And that brought Geordie fully to his senses. He frowned, and it was an expression of worry that was far healthier for all of us than his glare of bitter hatred.
"Christ, yes. We could drift right into that thing. We've got to get the foremast right out of its housing. Clear the shrouds, the lot.
dump it all overboard. It'll hamper Serena if she tries to give chase. Tuffy, Nick! His voice rose in command. The men gathered round, grasping their weapons and waiting for him to order them into battle. Instead, he began to give firm orders for freeing Esmeralda, and they recognized the urgency and sense in his voice. The fighting craze began to leave them all. I turned to Claire. "Are you all right?" I asked quietly. "Better now, darling." But even now, there wasn't time for more than that one quick moment of comfort. "Where are Paula and Mark?" I asked her. She nodded towards the saloon. "They're still in there. He's not too seriously hurt. He was sitting in a chair the last time I looked. But he won't give us any trouble, Mike. I've never seen him so subdued." "There are all the signs that Falcon will get rougher soon. I want you to get both of them up on deck. It'll be safer than staying below. And stay with your father, Claire. Keep them all together." I kissed her, and then she went into the saloon without a word. Geordie and the men had gone up on deck, and I followed. On board Serena, there was frantic activity as men wrenched and struggled with equipment at the base of the foremast. A similar scene was being enacted on our ship. There was no shooting, and of Hadley, there was no sign. With any luck, they had killed him themselves. I had a brief glimpse of our motor launch, still attached and dancing wildly astern of the litter strewn on deck, of Jim's body being passed below. I started to go forward and make myself useful. And then Falcon blew. There was a mighty roar as thousands of tons of water exploded into superheated steam. A bright, flickering glare shone on us, and the sunlight was dimmed as a pillar of steam ascended into the sky. The first wave reached us in less than 15 seconds. As I staggered, grabbing for support, I saw it racing down towards Esmeralda, silhouetted against the raging furnace. It was a monstrous wave, rearing mast high, creamed with dirty grey spume and coming with the speed of an express train. I crouched on the open deck, trying to flatten myself into the planking. The wave broke against Esmeralda. She heaved convulsively and ground against Serena. There was a rending crash, and I thought that both ships must have been stove in. A flood of near scalding water washed over the deck, and I writhed as I felt it in the stab wound in my side. Then the wave was past us, and the ships dipped in the afterwash, creaking and groaning in every timber. There were four more huge waves, but none as high as the first. I staggered to my feet, feeling the ship's curious writhing motion on the water. The waves had done what we had failed to do. Serena was dipping and bobbing in the water, about 50 yards away from us. Esmeralda was free, and she had no foremast at all. It had been plucked out by the roots. But every time Serena rolled, there was a crash which sent a shudder through her. I stumbled to the side and looked down into the water. Our foremast hung there, still tethered to Serena's mast by a cat's cradle of lines and spars. As I watched, a surge of water sent it slamming against her hull like a battering ram, and she shivered from stem to stern. She wouldn't stand much more of that treatment. I fell over a body, lying in the scuppers. Nick lay there with blood oozing from a wound in his forehead, but as I turned him over, he groaned and stirred and opened his eyes. He must have had a constitution like an ox, because in spite of the massive contusion, he began to struggle to his feet at once. I shouted, "Let's look for the others," and he nodded. We turned and then stood frozen in amazement as we caught a glimpse of Falcon. There was land back there. Land that glowed a dull red, shot with fiery gold streaks, and which surrounded the pit of hell itself. A vast, incandescent crater which spewed forth red-hot cinders and streams of lava. Falcon was building an island once more. The sea fought the new land, but the land was winning.
Nothing could stop the outpouring of that huge, gaping red mouth, but the sea did its best, pitting water against fire, and the result was an inferno.